Although you'd be hard-pressed to find a movie remake that's superior to the earlier version, Hollywood continues to churn them out. And despite the fact that political films are time-sensitive, a surprising number of them have been remade. So, for this month's political projections, we're comparing both versions of All the King's Men and The Manchurian Candidate, and joining me to discuss them are Gaspar Gonzalez, co-author of What They Have Built You to Do, The Manchurian Candidate, What Have They Built You to Do, The Manchurian Candidate in Cold War America, and returning to this series, Philip Janos, Chair of the Division of Politics, Administration, and Justice at California State University Fullerton, author of Politics and Politicians in American Film. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Or for me, good morning. Good afternoon to you.
Likewise. Good afternoon. It's nice to be here.
Well, Philip, why do you think so many political films have been remade?
Well, that's a good question, because I sort of agree with your initial comments, which is I think rarely does a remake do the job that the original did. Two reasons, I guess. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, for example, has been remade about three different times, I think, three or four different times.
None have come close.
Yes, yes. The 78 was, I think, the best, but stories are robust. And I think that's the reason, and I figure that they're always sort of hedging their bets a bit, thinking that a movie that has a reputation as a classic has something of a built-in audience, and therefore a little safer commercially to do.
Well, when you're remaking something that's considered a masterpiece by many, like Manchurian Candidate, then aren't you causing yourself some trouble? What did you think when you heard that it was being remade?
What did I think? I thought, oh, lordy, lordy, please don't do it. I almost don't want to see those movies, because always in the back of my mind, at least, is a comparison with the original, and it's hard to cleanse your mind of that. It's sort of like wine tasting. You have to cleanse your palate, I suppose, and it's really hard to do that if you know a movie and love it, for example, as I do The Manchurian Candidate.
And Gaspar, you devoted a whole book to The Manchurian Candidate,
yeah,
or at least a meditation on its implications. So were you surprised when they decided to remake it? Because they obviously couldn't just remake the original. Much of the story wouldn't have made sense in a modern world.
Yeah, I think I was filled with a similar kind of dread. It was a film that I love enough to co-write an entire book about it and its sort of implications for the culture. But I think I was actually pleasantly surprised. I don't think that the remake exceeded the original by any means. But I think it was rather shrewd. Demme's remake was rather shrewd in that it felt less like a remake than a readaptation, a contemporary adaptation of the novel, of the Richard Condon novel. There were elements, for example, in the Demme film that weren't in the original but were in the novel. In particular, for example, there's a meeting between Raymond Shaw and his mother that occurs in a hotel dining room. And also he stayed away from a lot of the more powerful and memorable iconography of the original. You know, there are no card tricks, for example. The Queen of Diamonds. There is none of that in the remake. And so I thought, while not as powerful a film as the original, I thought it was a pretty shrewd approach to the material.
Well, interestingly, some of the stuff in the original seems to be very specific to the time. For example, the brainwashing of Shaw seemed to suggest the widespread concern about television's brainwashing effect. That's something that we don't discuss much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that was actually something that was foremost in the mind of John Frankenheimer, who was the director, and George Axelrod, who was the screenwriter. And they talk about that in later interviews, that in some ways it was supposed to be a statement about the brainwashing capacity, if you will, of popular culture and television in particular. I mean, the original Manchurian Candidate is a film that's quite concerned with the power of television.
Philip, what do you think the film said about the political thinking at the time? Many people saw it as a as something that was satirizing McCarthyism.
Right. That's certainly an obvious element that the Island character stands out. When I show that film in a class that I do, I always ask the students at the end, suppose you were a right-winger who saw this film when it was first released, and suppose you were a left-winger who saw this film when it was first released. Would there be anything there that would make you happy? Would there be something you could walk away from the theater saying, ah, yes, that film spoke to me, either as a lefty or a righty? And the students used to do a very good job of pulling elements out for the film that would make a conservative happy and ones that would make a liberal happy, which is part of, I think, the success of a really well-done political film from the point of view of aiming it commercially in a way that gives elements of the audience things they want without alienating one big chunk of it or another big chunk of it. And the students, even nowadays, will pick up on the McCarthyite reference, and they'll know a little bit less about brainwashing. But they're aware of that period of American history sufficiently so that they're pretty comfortable with what they're seeing.
Well, Bennett Marco, the character played by Frank Sinatra, reads the Greek tragedy and name drops Orestes at one point.
Right.
Why are those references apt?
I think that's the key to the film. Mother is Clytemnestra, and Raymond is Orestes, and Johnny is Aegisthus, and it took me a while the first few times I saw that film to really take seriously what he says, because it's offhanded. He said, who are they? And he says, a couple of Greeks in a play. But if you look at the structure of the story, it's essentially classical tragedy laid over American Cold War politics.
Also, in the movie, women are powerful and men are weak.
Yes.
Was that in the book as well?
I haven't read the novel for a while, but Mother was beyond powerful. Mother was treacherous. Mother was sexual. As I recall, she's a drug addict. Mother is one piece of work in the film, and she's really a piece of work in the novel.
Gaspar, how would audiences have responded to these themes in 1962?
Well, I think the film, I mean, to pick up on Philip's point, I think the film both kind of constructs and deconstructs the idea of the Cold War. It's a sophisticated film, and I think at the time, I think it was condemned by both the American Legion and the American Communist Party. So everybody hated it.
There you go.
And actually, it didn't do badly at the box office. I mean, it didn't do as poorly as some people believe it did.
Really? I remember it as a big success. Everybody
I knew
went to see it.
Yeah, and then there was a myth that somehow it had been pulled because of the Kennedy assassination, which was actually sometime later.
Mm-hmm.
But it did rather well. It had Frank Sinatra, Janet Leigh. It was a huge all-star cast. But I think the themes would have resonated. It's the first film that really takes on the figure of Joe McCarthy, as Joe McCarthy. I mean, he's Johnny Island in the film, but it would almost be redundant to have called him Joe McCarthy. He was so obviously Joe McCarthy. That in terms of how topical it was rather topical. In fact, it was released, I believe, during the height of the missile crisis.
And then it was rediscovered in the late 1980s. In fact, Richard Condon was a guest on our show the day that it was featured at the New York Film Festival. It resonated differently at that time?
Well, I think it was. I mean, we have sort of an argument in our book, and I wrote it with Matthew Jacobson, who was a professor of American Studies at Yale University. And we sort of see it. Its resurgence, I mean, it was this kind of holy grail of Cold War culture. You know, people kind of remembered having seen it, and then it disappeared. Although, as we discovered, it didn't disappear entirely. I think it was an NBC movie of the week in 1974. There are other accounts of it kind of cropping up on television, in the days before cable and VCRs, when you just had to, and DVD players, when you just kind of stumbled across things. But I think when it was rediscovered in the late 80s, in a weird way, it intersected with the cultural currents of the 1980s. We had just had a spate of POW movies, the Chuck Norris movies, if you will. And this, and Mentoring Candidate, in a way, is a POW movie. And also it occurred during the Reagan presidency, and Reagan did a lot to sort of re-energize the Cold War, you know, the idea of the evil empire and so forth. So in some ways, the film took on a different life in the 1980s, I think, because it did resonate with currents of that moment.
We have to take a little break, and we'll go out, actually, with a clip from the film where Bennett Marco confronts Raymond Shaw about who controls him and what he may be commanded to do next. My guests are Gaspar Gonzalez, co-author of What Have They Built You to Do? The Manchurian Candidate in the Cold War America, and Philip Janos, chair of the Division of Politics, Administration, and Justice at California State University Fullerton, author of Politics and Politicians in American Film.
Now, Raymond, now the big one. Why is all of this being done? What have they built you to do?
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows except Beretsovo in Moscow and my American operator here. Or whatever it is, it's supposed to happen soon. Right at the convention. Maybe. I don't know. They can make me do anything, Ben. Can't they? Anything.
We'll see, kid. We'll see what they can do, and we'll see what we can do.
The primary season continues today in North Carolina and Indiana. WNYC will bring you results and analysis of the primaries throughout the evening. Tune in to AMA 20 at 9 p.m. for live coverage from NPR, followed by a national call-in special. And on 93.9 FM, WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein will periodically check in with evening music host Terrence McKnight to deliver updates. We're back with our discussion of films and remakes with Gaspar Gonzalez, who is co-author of What Have They Built You to Do? The Manchurian Candidate in Cold War America, and Philip Janos, who is the author of Politics and Politicians in American Film. We're talking about Manchurian Candidate, and we will in just a few moments be talking about All the King's Men. But we spent so much time on the original Manchurian Candidate. What do we learn from the later version? Obviously, they couldn't do it was post-Cold War. The references to Moscow don't make any sense. Do you think that Frankenheimer, in a way, predicted the dominance of private interest, which is the primary theme of the remake? Gaspar?
Oh, I don't. Well, in the Frankenheimer film, you don't really have sort of those private interests. I mean, you know, in the original, Manchuria is a place on the map. In the remake, it's Manchurian Global, which is a multinational.
Mm-hmm.
And that leap, I think, what was in the original, this kind of struggle between, you know, the U.S. and world communism, becomes more complex and more complicated in the remake, where you sort of have powers within the American government kind of conspiring with multinationals and business interests. And I think that nexus in some ways speaks to the current or the perception of the current moment.
Oh, on the other hand, they could have done replace the Cold War with the War on Terror, but Jonathan Demme or whoever made the decision resisted that.
Yeah, I mean, although the War on Terror obviously is referenced in some regards. I mean, it takes place during Operation Desert Storm in 1991. But yeah, no, I think he was more preoccupied with this idea of you know, his axis of evil, if you will, involves this nexus of the government and big business and
veiled references to people like Dick Cheney.
No doubt.
Philip, moving on to All the King's Men, which was also based on a novel written by Robert Penn Warren, a thinly veiled account of the rise and fall of Huey Long. Was Huey Long still famous at the time that the Rossin film came out?
Yes, he was certainly well enough known, I think. Huey Long died in 1935, so he certainly would have been on the minds of the audience and invisible, kind of in the same way that William Randolph Hearst was in the minds of the audience for Citizen Kane. He's obviously a larger-than-life figure, but Long had national ambitions and national publicity, so I think the audience would have certainly have been aware of him. Yeah.
And he was rather controversial. He was called a populist, a socialist, a fascist. Depending on who was being the critic.
Right. It's sort of like the beginning of Citizen Kane, where Charles Foster Kane is called a communist, a fascist, That's exactly what Huey Long was, and he was a severe challenge to Franklin Roosevelt. So he was to be taken very seriously politically, just as a challenge to the sort of moderate liberalism of Franklin Roosevelt.
The film came out in 1948, and it was at a time when America was trying to decide where it wanted to go. And although the Cold War is not an issue here, it is definitely in the background. We have a clip where Willie Stark, played by Broderick Crawford, he's the Huey Long character, gives a rousing speech to a group of rural Louisianans. He has just realized that he needs to tap into people's emotions.
But I am going to tell you a story. It's about a hick. A hick like you, if you please. Yeah, like you. He grew up on the dirt roads and the gully washes of a farm. He knew what it was to get up before dawn and get feed and slop and milk before breakfast and then set out before sunup and walk 6 miles to a one-room slab-sided schoolhouse. Oh, this hick knew what it was to be a hick, all right. He figured if he was going to get anything done, well, he had to do it himself. So he sat up nights and studied books. He studied law because he thought he might be able to change things some for himself and for folks like him. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. He didn't start off thinking about the hicks and all the wonderful things he was going to do for them, no. No, he started off thinking of number one. But something came to him on the way. How he could do nothing for himself without the help of the people, that's what came to him.
Do you think that these issues of class were familiar to people who were attending that film in the late 40s?
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, they had. This is a country that had just gone through the Great Depression, of course, which is fundamentally about class. In fact, I see, if you look at the films of that era, I see a class dealt with typically much more explicitly than you do, excuse me, with more recent films. And it also seems to me that, at least in terms of when the film was, I don't recall when the novel was written, but in terms of when the film was released, at least, that the U.S. had gone through a period of, you know, considerable challenges on the right and on the left of a more radical nation. It was the heyday of Communist Party voting, Socialist Party voting, Father Coughlin on the right. There were pretty severe challenges on both the right and the left through the Depression and through the early part of the war. And I suppose in some way it was safer to do those things in a film in 1948 once a kind of consensus had been reached. But Long, for a lot of people, was one very scary guy.
Well, it's about demagoguery, and this is before McCarthy winds up rising to his position of power. So people wouldn't have seen that. It might very well have reflected the audience's lingering fears of fascism.
Well, sure. And if you go back to a Frank Capra film, Meet John Doe, you see a similar sort of thing dealt with. Meet John Doe is, I think, early 40s, where you've got demagoguery, a sort of quasi-fascist demagoguery, the use of the media, a face in the crowd. I think a Nina Kazan film in which there's a sort of doofus radio guy played by Andy Griffith who becomes a demagogue.
Now, a major part of the story is about Jack Burden, played by John Ireland. I thought Broderick Crawford was magnificent. I thought John Ireland was a real problem, personally. But still, he is the moral center of the film, and he is a guy who gets caught up in it, gets seduced by the demagoguery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a major part of the story, isn't it? It's really not about Willie Stark, who is this almost iconic figure. It's about what happens to the rest of us when we come under the sway of somebody like that.
I think that the movie is essentially a tragedy, as in its way as a Manchurian Candidate. I mean, virtually everybody is destroyed by Willie Stark except Jack Burton. And he's sort of the centrist, wishy-washy, ambivalent kind of guy. There's a similar character, I think similar name, in Primary Colors. But yeah, the Willie Stark absolutely lays waste to everybody.
So what about the remake from 2006, which was written and directed by Steven Zaillian? How does it compare?
Well, you know, I don't have a terribly clear recollection of that film because it just didn't hit me with any particular force. You know, as Gaspar was saying, I think that the remake of Manchurian Candidate was sort of artfully done with some things modified. And I didn't respond to the remake of All the King's Men.
And neither did anybody else in America,
right,
it seems.
Yeah, the reviews were quite negative. And you know, given the cast and all the rest, I was hoping that's one of those remakes that I wanted to see with some hope. Actually.
Well, Gaspar, do you remember the film well?
Actually, it's funny. I watched it recently, kind of in anticipation of this conversation. Yeah, it sort of has the smell of mothballs about it. I mean, it's the remake does. I mean, it feels like a period piece because in some ways it is. I mean, it's set in the 50s.
It seems to play up Stark's religiosity that part of the populism more than the original.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Penn, who's a marvelous actor, but he sort of plays. I mean, his Willie Stark kind of reminded me more of Jerry Lee Lewis than it did of Huey Long.
Well, maybe we can listen to a little clip and get a sense of just how thick his accent was.
Whatever man, woman, and child who's sick or in pain can go in, knowing they'll get all a man can do. Not as charity, but as a right, as your right, as it is that every child shall have a complete education, that no person, aged or infirm, shall want or beg for bread, that no poor man's land or house will be taxed, that you shall not be deprived of hope. And if any man stands between me and fulfilling your rights, I will strike him down. So help me God.
One of my producers said that he watched the film with closed captioning because he couldn't understand everything that Sean Penn was saying.
A few reviewers, I think, made the same point.
Now, it seemed to me, Broderick Crawford, this was the great performance of his life, and it was really a subtle performance. This is a lot less subtle, perhaps because of changes in American political attitudes?
Well, if I can take that, I think, you know, it's funny. I was watching it, and it reminds me of, it kind of belongs, I think, to a bigger theme, which is we keep going back to the 50s, it seems. I mean, it seems that we've sort of been stuck in the 50s now for a few years in terms of our cinematic culture, prominent films like Good Night and Good Luck and maybe the most obvious one. But I think what we're drawn to is, you know, and this is a film, the original, that really takes up this issue of when the people becomes the mob, we the people as opposed to we the mob. And the films of the 40s, late 40s and the 50s, the films of the Cold War, really seem to tackle or attempted to tackle these sorts of sociological questions. I mean, it was a very kind of introspective time. Questions of alienation, of conformity, of resistance. And I think that that's kind of what our cinematic culture is grappling for. And so far it sort of has found it mostly in these films of the 50s. I mean, that's sort of my theory on why these films get remade.
Well, does the Stark in the remake resemble any politician since Huey Long?
I couldn't really. It's an excellent question. I couldn't think of one in particular. I mean, I think when I see the original all the King's Men. I mean, he anticipates Joe McCarthy with this sort of beefy, jowly demagogue. And in many ways, also, he's reminiscent of Richard Nixon in terms of his appeal, not necessarily his style, but his appeal, this idea that he's one of us, which I think was the slogan Nixon's first campaign for Congress back in 46. Mm-hmm. But the Willie Stark of the remake didn't remind me of anyone in particular. I don't know if Philip...
No, it didn't me either. I suppose stylistically, in some tiny way, maybe George Wallace a bit. But for me, the big contrast between the original and the remake is fundamentally Broderick Crawford and the way he does the performance. And because, as I said, I view that film as essentially a tragedy, and there's a sort of buffoonish quality to the remake that, for me, detracts from the truly tragic nature of that. And sort of grand nature of that story.
Well, maybe it seems fitting to remake the movie because it touches on the politics of division, which is what Americans are saying they're disillusioned about now.
Well, and there is that element. I mean, one of the interesting things about remakes, I think, is to say, okay, here's a film made at a certain time, and 30 years later it's remade. What elements are removed from the first one, and I think more importantly, what elements are exported from what appears to be the current circumstance of the country into the new film to try to make it more palatable, more relevant, more accessible. And as often as not, for me, that doesn't work. But that's partly because I'm comparing it with the original.
Well, the words elitist didn't come into this film, although there and nobody could have known what would be happening during this political campaign. But to some degree, elitism is part of what Willie Stark accuses all of his critics of.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's just a full-on attack, and you see that in different ways in a lot of films in the 1930s, too, gangster films and some of Frank Capra's films and that sort of thing.
The next in this political projection series will be on June 3rd, when we'll be looking at how the movies have depicted machine politics. My great thanks to today's guest, Philip Janos, who is chairman of the Division of Politics, Administration, and Justice at California State University Fullerton, and also Gaspar Gonzalez, author of the Manchurian Candidate book. On tomorrow's show, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the U.S. commander in Iraq from June 2003 to June 2004 on Abu Ghraib and the current state of affairs in Iraq and what he wishes he had done differently. Also, Israeli author Edgar Keret. States of the Union is all about the issues that matter to voters in Nebraska. Plus, Al and Larry Ubell answer your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Paula Crossfield, Dina Mann, and Stephanie Hughes. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.